Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, this is Chris Martinson of ChrisMartinson.com, and today we're going to be talking about a very important subject. We're going to be talking about how the stock market works, specifically about something called high-frequency trading and its importance to you, its importance to the markets, and its importance to our future. We are very fortunate today to be talking with Joe Saluzzi, a partner, co-founder, co-head of the equity trading firm Themis Trading, a leading independent agency brokerage firm that trades equities for institutional money managers and hedge funds. Prior to Themis, Joe headed the team responsible for equity sales and trading for major institutional accounts at Instinet Corporation for more than 9 years. He's a frequent speaker on issues involving market access, algorithmic trading, other sell and buy side concerns. He's provided expert commentary for media outlets such as 60 Minutes, Bloomberg, CNBC, Wall Street Journal, many others. Joe, welcome. It's a real pleasure to be able to talk to you today.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So why don't you tell people a little bit about your background some more? I used the word Instinet, but people might not know what that means.
Sure. Instinet was one of the original ECNs, which back in the early 90s, it was slow going to get traction, but it became quite the, you know, it was the original electronic trading forum for most institutional investors. I spent, like you said, about 9 years there managing one of their institutional desks as well as the broker-dealer desk. After I left there, actually, my partner Sal Arnick was also an Instinet veteran, and we decided to start our own agency shop, which we do now. We trade our job during the day. And my job is to trade for institutional clients to make sure that they are not, you know, shall we say, you know, to get best execution for them. For the first 3 or 4 years of our firm, you know, everything was great, and we didn't really notice too much of a difference in the markets. But we started noticing a lot over the past few years, which kind of brought us into a new area that we've been developing and working on, and it's just market research and in delving into market structure and how that has changed, particularly since 2007 when Reg NMS was fully implemented, and how now, you know, the name of the game is necessarily fundamental analysis or technical analysis. It's all about speed.
About speed. So I really want to give you room to run on this story today, because I think it's a really important story. It's been given far too little attention. And it really deserves maybe more time than the average 3.5-minute TV spot can afford. So let's talk about that stock market and how it functions, or maybe I should say dysfunctions. Arguably, the stock market, it's the critical signaling mechanism for which most people take their cues about how the economy is doing, how it's likely to perform in the future. So if the stock market's doing well, it's going up, consumers are more confident, more likely to spend, or so the story goes. The stock market is where people risk their savings, though, and in the hopes of growing their wealth. And therefore, it's really vitally important that the market be perceived as free, fair, equal, and confidence in the market itself is important to that. So let me tell you, let's go back to May 6, 2010. That's a day where it shook my confidence in the market to the core. What happened then?
Well, that it's an interesting thing. I mean, if you read the report, the CFTC joint SEC panel, they'll tell you one thing, and they'll kind of blame one particular firm. Most people took away from that report that it was one particular large institutional trader who sent in a large order, which basically crashed the market. And that's what we looked at that and we said, no, that's not exactly what happened here. Okay, what happened here? Yes, that order was in the market, and you know, there was the order in question was a large 75,000 contract E-mini order, which was set to trade for 9% of the volume. That's not that big of an order. It is a big order, but the algo was set to be not more than 9%. It didn't have a limit on or anything like that, but it was in the E-minis, which is the most liquid contract out there. Well, what happened on that day wasn't necessarily the order. That may have kind of exacerbated a few things, but that day started breaking down earlier in the day when there was some news about the Greek riots and so on. There was lots of nervousness in the market. Things started to get a little shaky. When the order did come in, it basically expose the market and the major market structure flaws that we have out there now, in that there are no real liquidity providers, there are no specialists, there are not many humans out there to kind of stop something when things go wrong. And things went horribly wrong there. What happened was, and one of the guys over at the CFTC refers to it as hot potato volume, and his name is Andrei Kirilenko, he's the main economist there. What happened is the volume just started to kind of feed off of itself, and normally these, you know, quote-unquote high-frequency traders will be on one side of a trade and look to flip it out immediately just to scalp a penny or two. Well, they couldn't get out fast enough. They were buying a little bit, and then it just kind of cycled down. And before you knew it, all the bids were disappearing. And the problem with the equity market now is that it's linked to so many other markets. All markets are linked together, probably due to high-frequency trading and going cross-asset and so on. But many of the ETFs, which are priced off of equities, started to fall quickly. Bids disappeared, and everybody just got the heck out of the way, bottom line. And even afterwards, some of the high-frequency traders were quoted in the paper saying, well, we just walked away. Why would we stand there and take a hit and get killed like that? And then we wouldn't even know if the trades were going to be broken afterwards. Well, you know, to be honest, that's a valid concern. They have no obligation. They have no requirement to be there. Why would they stand there? And that is the problem with the market. There are no real, you know, no one's required to be anywhere. Yet, there are many guys out there who are getting huge benefits off the market structure, but they don't have any requirements to stand there anymore. It's a tough game. The spreads aren't there for them. Why would you stand there when there's a penny spread? I mean, back in the days when they were specialists, they would stand there, but they had a bigger spread involved, and that's why they would be afforded, you know, they would commit some capital because they knew they had less risk. The game has changed now. When you have a penny spread and no real liquidity provider who's going to stand there, you get days like May 6th. And the question that I get asked a lot is, can that happen again? Well, that's not the question. The question is, when will it happen again? It will definitely happen again.
So in May 6th, we had that, you know, that plunge of, I forget what the total number was, well over 1,000 at one point. And then really damaging to my psyche was the way in which the trades were arbitrarily broken. I thought it was arbitrary. At least they were never explained to me in a way that I said, oh, I get that. You know, they drew a line and said, below that, forget about it. We're just going to bust those, which to my knowledge has not happened before. So that was a kind of a unique and still poorly explained event. But so was the flash crash itself. Like you said, I think the story that got circulated for my consumption through the Wall Street Journal et al. Was that there was that, you know, one trader in the Midwest who dumped a few E-minis out there. But really what you're saying is that the core problem here is that the liquidity, such as it is, the trading volume, maybe I should use the words more precisely, the trading volume is really dominated by these computer boxes that are trading.
There's no doubt. The estimates from some independent research firms are as high as 70%. We've heard somewhere between 50 and 70% being automated trading, or, you know, there's different types of strategies. There's stat arb, there's liquidity rebates, there's predatory. There's all different types of these guys, so it's kind of, but if you added them all up, it is dominated by computers now. And the traditional institutional investor no longer has that, you know, price discovery power anymore. They're kind of just following along. But just to go back real quick to your point of why did they break certain trades and why didn't they? They kind of drew a line, like you said, at 60%, anything above or beyond 60%, which was an arbitrary number, which basically a bunch of exchange executives got together at the end of that night and decided this is where we're going to break them. Nobody really questioned it. And, you know, heck, if I would have gotten caught in one of those trades, I'd be pretty upset right now. If you had a stop loss order out there and then it was, say, 40%, you got kicked out, and then the next day it opens up, you know, flat or something like that. Yeah, you got taken advantage of. And then what they did was they blamed the stop-loss market order, saying, oh, you shouldn't have a stop-loss market order. Well, if you're trading IBM or Microsoft or GE or, you know, Procter & Gamble, who would have thought that a stop-loss would drop at 14 points, right? So that's not the problem. Again, don't blame the victim, which is what they were trying to do here. You know, you got to blame the system. And really, that's part of that is the problem. And back to the other point is, yeah, they've taken over the market. The equity market in the United States is now controlled by the machines. There's no doubt about it. They own, you know, they're controlling all the volume. If you look at Citibank, it's a perfect example of a stock that is all controlled by basically rebate traders. They're just looking to collect a small fee, from the exchanges will pay them for posting liquidity, and then they look to sell the stock exactly at the same price, and they'll try to collect a fee on the other side. It's ridiculous. It's volume for the sake of volume. That's not what a market's supposed to be about.
So what we have is we have these boxes that are trading back and forth. So somebody's written a computer program, and this computer program is looking at not fundamentals per se, but really they're just looking at market structure, like how many shares are short or long at this point in time, or what's the bid-ask spread at this point in time, or are there orders coming in from institutions that I can front run a little bit, buy the shares a millisecond in front of them and then sell them to them 2 milliseconds later. That's what we're talking about here, right?
Right, and there's, like I said, there's different types. There's guys who are a traditional statistical arbitrage trader adds a value to the system. You need statistical arbitrage traders. They smooth out prices. If prices were to get out of whack in one market versus another, there is an arbitrage opportunity. They'll take advantage of that. They'll make a small profit, but they'll keep prices in line. Traditionally, that's a good thing, but now you have pretty much, you know, arbitrage for the sake of arbitrage. Sometimes they're arbitraging, you know, one ETF versus another, or, you know, one exchange versus another, which gets a little crazy. But, you know, the part of the trading that concerns us is more of the predatory style, like you just mentioned, where if there's an institution out there and they're out there buying stock and someone can detect that order. Okay, and then traditionally, again, trading is a predatory, and we always make this point, trading is predatory. There's a winner, there's a loser. If you're better than me, you're going to do a better job than me. And if your machine works better, you're going to take advantage of it. However, when you're getting an advantage that not everyone has, well, then we have situations, for instance, flash orders. Okay, flash orders were a big controversy, May of 2009. It's been almost 2 years now. And they still exist in the market, and a lot of people are confused. Sometimes they call they'll call high-frequency trading flash trading. That's not the, a flash order is a very specific thing where an exchange will show an order to a subset of their users and give them basically a half-a-second look or peek at the order before they will send it out to the general lit exchanges or the, you know, the places that are displayed. Well, that doesn't make any sense. You're giving a subset an advantage, and that person doesn't have to trade against it. They can just say, no thanks, I don't want to sell you that. Instead, I'll buy the stock ahead of you. And they can do that because it's not their client, so essentially it's not front-running. It's technically not a front-running thing. There's one exchange particular out there now, and I don't want to name right now, but they still undergo the price. They're still doing it. And the other exchanges are up in arms because they're losing business to them, saying, how can you still do this? The SEC has had the proposal to ban flash orders out for over a year now, and they still haven't done anything about it. And that's just one particular example of predatory trading that goes on. There's all sorts of other things that they can do, particularly in some of these dark pools, which a lot of people talk about, and that's a lot of where you'll see these sub-penny prices happening, where an order can be sent to an internalizer or a broker who basically specializes in internalizing and crossing those stocks. Well, in a market that's tight and is working well, they love doing that because that's free money for them. But when things get tough, and by the way, I'll just make this one point. On May 6th, one of the biggest problems, and this was in the SEC's report that certainly didn't get any headlines, the biggest problem was that internalizers did no longer internalize the trades. They didn't execute them. They sent them to the lit market. They sent them to the exchanges, and they said, here, you fill this order. I don't want it. Well, the exchanges weren't prepared for that. There was no liquidity that normally would be out there, and basically that exacerbated the problem even more. So if you have an internalizer who's making a profit off of these trades, yet doesn't have a responsibility to trade when they come into them, you're getting a free look with no obligation. That's the bottom line there.
So if I got that right, so the public market it has these high-frequency traders and all these algorithms running, but there's a private market as well, the dark pools. It's an off-exchange trading volume. So there's some volume happening off-exchange. We're not really seeing it, but when a crisis came, like on May 6th, some of that private volume came squishing over into the public markets, if I put it that way.
I'm prepared for it. And I'll give you a quick example or a quick number. In 2008, the percentage of trades that were printed to the TRF, which is a trade reporting facility where not off-exchange stuff happens, was 14% of the overall volume. In 2010, that number went up to 32%. Okay, now that tells you there's a huge increase in these dark pools, and we always like to make a distinction between different types of dark pools, and this is where the industry kind of shot themselves in the foot. They got these things labeled as dark pools, and then, of course, that sounds very predatory, and most of them, you know, they're not necessarily adding value, but there are three of them in particular that are good. They're institutional. They're these block, we call them crossing networks, and, you know, I won't get into all the names now, but a good institutional crossing network with an average volume of, say, average daily trade size of 35,000 shares or more, they're serving a purpose to help institutions find each other to reduce the friction in the market so they can execute trades back and forth. That's what a crossing network is. Well, they've kind of morphed into these dark pools, which are just, like we said before, internalization engines who are just looking to basically profit off of retail flow and other things. And they're driving out a lot of the volume off the exchange, which basically then takes the price discovery away from the market because the lit market, you can no longer feel the supply and demand. And it's hurting price discovery, and that causes a huge problem.
I see that problem, but that increase of 14 to 32% over 2 years, to me that makes sense. If let's devil's advocate, I'm CalPERS, and I know that there's this high frequency skimming going on, and I don't want to be part of that. Wouldn't I want to participate in dark pool transactions?
The thing, we go back to the traditional crossing network versus those three crossing networks, and basically it's LiquidNet, ITG, and Pipeline. Those are institutional crossing networks. They haven't seen an uptick in volume in those 2 years. it's not their volume that's going up. So it's not that the CalPERS of the world and the large institutions are finding more liquidity in those networks. The volume going up are from the dark pool internalization engines, which are sometimes, some of them are fine, some of them are more predatory. So you have to be very, very careful when you're trading for an institution. And again, that's what we do here for a living. We trade for institutional clients as to where is my order being sent. Is it being sent to a dark pool, which I consider toxic, which houses a lot of, you know, predatory order flow? And the reason, and here's another little secret that no one talks about, the reason why these orders are being sent to these exchanges and to these dark pools is because of the pricing scheme that goes on amongst broker routers. So when you send out an order as an institution, it gets routed through a smart order router. Well, there's a pecking order. It will try to go to the cheapest version first. And most of the time, those are dark pools that are free. So the broker has an incentive to go to these toxic pools and send your order there, because that way his cost is lower and he can say to you, okay, here's my algorithm. I'll only charge you half a penny per share, because he knows his cost on the other side is either zero, or even in some cases now they get rebated to trade with some of these exchanges who are now doing this inverted pricing scheme, which is just a whole other story. So the order has a disincentive. You have to be very, very careful as an institution when you're sending an order. Where is it going and how is it being routed? And that's what we kind of, I mean, this is really deep into the microstructure world of markets, but you have to be careful. And this is what we watch.
Well, that sounds, I hate to sound naive about that. That sounds just enormously complicated and opaque and like an ever-shifting landscape. It sounds like the technology is perhaps run faster than our ability to understand the impacts, the risks, to manage it appropriately. I mean, I'm thinking about the SEC having trouble managing very obvious things. It's things that seem completely obvious to me, like options backdating. I mean, that's like doesn't take any genius to understand that, and still they struggled with it. So this sounds like an order of magnitude, or maybe more complex to me.
It is, and like you said, it's constantly changing. If they do catch on to something, they just kind of shift it around again. The other side, the high-frequency trading world and the automated trading side is enormous, and the money that's being made there is also enormous. So they have huge resources at their disposal. They can kind of shift things around. When a strategy doesn't work, they just change it up. But who in the end is always the loser, and almost, you know, it is the institutional and retail investor, because their orders are, you know, ever so small, are getting a little bit of siphoning every time, and that money is being fed into the other side of the high-frequency trading world. Now, it is a strategy. There's nothing illegal here about, and I always make this point very clear, high-frequency trading is not illegal. You know, certain strategies are not illegal, but they do morph, some of them, on what is, you know, it is a very gray area. So they do have, the SEC needs to understand it. The biggest problem that they have, the SEC, is they don't have a consolidated audit trail right now. So what happened on May 6th was, it took them 5 months to analyze 15 minutes of trades. Okay, that right away, there's a red flag. What's going on here? Why did it take you guys so long? Well, they had to piece together various exchange feeds and various audit trails. There's one called OATS, which is the FINRA audit trail, and that will track NASDAQ securities. That's a good thing. Well, we don't have one for the New York, okay, and we don't have one for options. So they had to kind of put it all together like a quilt, a big quilt where they patched it together. They need to get, and there's a proposal for a consolidated audit trail, which would allow them at their fingertips to see what's going on, who's doing it, why did this happen. They would be able to track a heck of a lot more, but it's an expensive thing to build. And if you saw yesterday, there was an article, the SEC was complaining that they're underfunded. They don't have the resources anymore. Well, if you're a bad guy and you know that the cops aren't watching that bank, are you going to go rob that bank? Well, most people would say, no, I'm not a bad guy. I don't feel it's not ethical. I'm not going to rob a bank. But guess what? There are a few people in this world that will say, I'm going to go rob that bank until they're watching. And that's what you got going on right now.
Well, you know, so this helps put some things in context for me. For listeners out there who maybe aren't as deep into the market, I just want to put one point of clarification in, which is that we're talking about trading, which is different from investing. Investing, you know, you're exposed to market returns, and that's all well and good. You buy GM a decade ago, and hopefully it goes up. And that's your investing return. But trading is a zero-sum game, as I understand it. So your loss is my gain and vice versa. And so what we're talking about here are in the dark pools in the HFT world, it sounds like most of this is just about trading and securing trading gains. So help me understand two things. So TradeBot reports 4 years of consistent returns trading. I believe it's a win every single day. I see the big trading desks, the prop desks off the big banks. They're turning in perfect trading quarters. How does that fit into this thing you're talking about?
Right. Most retail investors will say exactly, well, Joe, you know, why should I care? This sounds like minutiae. Well, if you are invested, let's just say, in a 401k, and your 401k happens to own some mutual funds or ETFs or is somehow invested in the stock market, well, then your fund, if they're not extremely careful and do the things that we're talking about when they're trading, is subject to leakage in their performance. So maybe instead of earning 12% that year, they only earned 11.2% because they lost a few basis points on leakage. And guess where that money went? That went to the guys, to the high-speed traders who were able to basically maybe scalp a penny here or there, collect a rebate here or there. And then that, you know, it's kind of like the movie Office Space where the penny scheme adds up, right? A penny here, a penny there. Well, before you know it, that's some real money that we're talking about. So if you are invested in the market, yeah, you are subject to lose a little here because it is a zero-sum game, Chris. You said it right on the head. Somebody wins and somebody loses. How can an industry be purported, and it's been reported that they're making billions and billions of dollars? It's got to be coming from somewhere, okay? And it's almost, you know, it's an invisible profit machine, if you want to call it. Nobody really sees it. But there is leakage on the trades. There's no doubt about it. And that's what you have to be careful of.
Well, it almost seems like a license to steal to me. I mean, you know, I was a trader for a while. It was something I did from my home. You know, I'm just a small-time retail guy. I know that, you know, a really good year for me, I'd be, you know, hitting it like 60%, 65%. That would be like phenomenal. In fact, I don't think I had a year with 65% in it. But, you know, you're shooting for over 50 somewhere. But these guys are turning in 100% win ratios. The statistics on that say they're not trading, not like I was anyway. They're doing something very different than what I was doing. So anything where you have a guaranteed profit is not a trade. It's nothing's at risk. It's a completely different world than I'm familiar with as a small-time trader.
Right, and the reason why they're guaranteed, and really I guess there's nothing guaranteed, but they invest a lot of money in technology. It's all about technology with these guys. It is an arms race when it comes to who has the best speed. And they, you know, they used to talk about milliseconds a few years ago. Now they talk about microseconds, which are a millionth of a second. Okay, that's the kind of latency we're looking at. And if anybody, whoever has the fastest speed computer, will beat the other guy. They're always racing against each other, these guys, to beat the other guy, to try to beat that institutional order, there's always one loser, like I said before, and that's usually the institution and the retail. But if you're out there trying to trade, and say you're a day trader, you're not going to beat the machines, okay? You are not going to beat the machines. You will always be too slow. If you're an investor, that's a different story. You know, you don't really care. You don't have necessarily the 5-minute time frame or the 10-minute time frame that some of these guys do. You like, you know, whatever. You found Apple or whatever stock you like, and you think it's a good investment, and you did your research, and you did your own homework, and you say, you know what, I'm going to keep this. I think this is a good investment. Well, then these things that we're talking about probably won't affect you too much. But if you're a trader, as a lot of guys are out there, well, you need to be very careful. And I bet that win ratio is a heck of a lot lower now for most professional day traders because they can't fight the machine. You're not going to win.
You know, this tracks my experience perfectly. In 2003 and 4, I did pretty well. Something began shifting in about 2005. You know, what I was used to be doing didn't work. And by 2007, I had to quit because what I was doing was failing. My experience was I would watch these massive orders swamp the bid at critical junctures, for example, or, you know, for both individual stocks, the whole index. I would see levels leap over key resistant points, meaning that a limit fill was no longer good enough. Sometimes they would cruise right past your limit, and so you would have to have these stopgap market orders, and those were horrible, you know. So I just found myself getting my pocket picked, and it was just a little bit here and there, and I realized I was up against something I didn't understand, I couldn't compete with. It went off. So I had to quit.
We hear that a lot from professional, you know, day traders, that things have changed. No longer do the technical patterns that have lasted for years and years that are written about all over, they don't really work anymore. So what a lot of guys have done, and I give them credit, is they've adapted. And they know now that they have to live in a different world where maybe a traditional breakout, where you think it's going to break down or break out, whatever, it doesn't work anymore. So they kind of go alongside now. And, you know, what we're in now right now is a very, you know, it's obviously a momentum-fueled market and things are a little bit different. But you do have to adapt your trading strategy. But it's still, I mean, you're fighting a battle which is very difficult to be won. And just to give an example, I mean, the type of traders that are out there now, you know, it used to be dominated by institutional volume, and the block trade was the big deal. When you saw the block, you know, stocks would kind of move accordingly. Well, that the blocks are minuscule now compared to the overall volume. Most of the volume is, you know, 100-share prints, 200. The average trade size is like less than 200 shares now. That's because the type of trades have changed. When 70% are hyperspeed traders who could care less about what a company does for a living or who the CEO is, they just care about making a penny or two and flipping it and getting flat, by the way, at the end of the day, nobody holds positions, of course, well, then this is what you're up against. So if you can adapt, hey, good luck, but there are not many people out there that can adapt without that type of weaponry. You need the machines, okay? And it's not cheap to get into. You need millions and millions of dollars to build your own system, and then you feel, you're fighting up against the big banks, the large brokerage firms, the large HFT firms. You're not going to win, okay? So it's a very difficult game as a trader, and I'm glad you made that distinction, because investing is still, investing is investing.
Right, right. But at the same time, you know, what I saw after the flash crash, which, by the way, it broke my confidence for two reasons. One, that it happened and wasn't well explained, and two, that they broke the trades. And I guess now I have to add a third thing, which is, from my perspective, I haven't seen any significant fundamental rule changes, systems implementations changes. Am I wrong in that? Is something fundamentally changed here?
You are right on the money. What we've gotten is a couple of Band-Aids that have been placed on because there was obviously outrage afterwards. And one of the Band-Aids was the circuit breaker. Okay, so they put in single stock circuit breakers where if a stock moves 10% or more in, within a 5-minute time period, they will halt that stock. Well, guess what? That's not really going to help much. Because if a flash crash could happen in 5 minutes and the market would be down 10%, and that is pretty much what we had on May 6th. That's an extremely damaging event. Like you just said, the confidence. When you lose that confidence in the market, it doesn't come back, which is why the equity mutual outflows from May 6th up until recently were out every week. Money was coming out of the market because investors didn't trust the equity market anymore. Now they're starting to come back in, of course, and it feels toppy to me, but now money's coming into the market, which you kind of get scared there. You're saying, well, why are these people buying now? Mm-hmm. But when you lose confidence in an equity market, it just doesn't build overnight. So what the SEC has to come in and say is, you know, we've got some major overhauls here. We're going to be taking care of making this fair. But here's the problem. It's all about money. Okay, it's always about money. And it's all about who has the bigger lobby and who has the bigger funded lobby. And right now, running around Washington, D.C., are a huge HFT lobbyists who are talking to all the politicians saying, nothing's wrong here, guys. They're like the traffic cop at the accident saying, keep moving, folks. There's nothing to see here. And they're pretty much winning the battle. Okay, we used to have one lone senator who would help and try to have a voice of reason, Senator Kaufman from Delaware, who is now out of office. His term expired and he didn't run. There's nobody out there right now really for investor protection. And one of the other biggest problems is that the exchanges, who normally most investors look to the exchanges as protectors for investors, and their number one goal is to make sure that everyone's treated fairly. Well, guess what? Exchanges are all for-profit organizations now, not a non-profit. Some of them are public, okay? Two of them are public. The number one goal of a for-profit corporation is to make money, is to make sure their shareholders are happy. And if that means cutting corners and cutting deals with guys who normally they wouldn't have done, they're going to do it. That's why they still do flash orders. That's why they have inverted rebate schedules. That's why they're doing all sorts of different things to make sure they court the most volume. There's our problem. We point to it all the time. We say that high-frequency trading is just a strategy being used by certain people, and it's allowed, but it's being given to them by the regulators and the exchanges who either don't know or are looking the other way, and there is no reform going on right now, and it's scary because, like you said before, what's to prevent another flash crash? There isn't anything out there. But if you hear the exchange heads, they will confidently get up there on TV saying, there will not be another flash crash. Oh, yeah? Can you guarantee me that? I will take the other side of that bet.
Well, I'd like to talk about the risks for a moment, because one of the other things that sort of drove me out of trading, I decided my time was better spent elsewhere, was that not only were some of the technical signals, other things breaking down, and I was seeing weird market behavior, but I used to count on having some sort of hedging in the cross or anti-correlations between asset classes. And so in 2003, you know, if the trade report came in one way, the dollar would do something and then gold would do something else, you could sort of count on it. Now everything's correlated, hinged off of it. They all seem to be like one giant market to me. In fact, it's not just U.S., it's global. If you want to know what the Dow did, just pull up the FTSE. If you can tell them apart, you're an expert. And so I look at that, and so one of the risks I feel in my gut around this is that with all of these things cross-correlated now, and with these overlapping conflicts of interest you're talking about, where perhaps an exchange owns a piece of a trading firm, which then owns a piece of the exchange, and in fact, it might cross multiple exchanges. It's so complicated that Dr. Venn himself probably couldn't diagram this thing at this point, right? So I have this view now of this giant cross-correlated, interlocked, possibly with conflicts of interest overlapping the whole thing market, and that's my view of it at this point in time, but it feels enormously risky because...
I think you're right on. I mean, the correlation is incredible. Most guys have been shaking their heads all last year saying, how could we have correlated markets like this? It doesn't make any sense. Why is this trading with this asset class trading with that asset class? Why doesn't anything seem to work anymore? Well, it's probably because there are so many guys out there trading cross-asset, and that's what they do. They don't just trade equities, obviously. The machines can see everything, right? Okay, they have the electronic eyes out there. And they will trade and pretty much squeeze out any sort of arbitrage opportunity immediately, which is why most of the time when you see the daily chart patterns, probably over the last year, you'll see this really tight intraday move. Nothing going on. You'll see maybe a move in the beginning of the day and a little at the end, and you can go to sleep in the middle because they've got it tightly controlled. And just like a rubber band, when you stretch it out as far as you can, eventually it snaps. And right now, it is a very well-stretched out rubber band where these guys are, you know, the tape is, it does feel weird, yeah. And when it snaps, you get a May 6th. And then it'll correct itself, and everyone will say, okay, don't worry, we're fine again, until it happens again. You know, that's not exactly a confidence-building market.
No, and it's that degree of correlation, which it represents an unknown risk. So we all fear the unknown. I'm in that class. But when I wonder, so if we have another flash crash, maybe this time it starts in stocks, or maybe it starts in bonds, or maybe it bleeds over into the derivatives markets, right? You know, who knows? Maybe all of a sudden interest rate swaps are blowing out. And, you know, it just feels like what the flash crash taught me was that once the market electronically breaks down, there are no firewalls. You know, there's no... There's, you know, it's just one big open building in there.
And it's like a vacuum. It will just, it'll plunge down just like it did on May 6th, and it'll just be air out there. It'll be an air pocket, and it'll go. Okay? It is what it is. And unfortunately, the problem here, and this is something that we always get hung up on, you know, what is the purpose of an equity market? Is the purpose of an equity market to raise capital so that small companies can become big companies, so they can hire people and create jobs and create value-added products? Or is it the purpose of the equity market to be a giant casino where everyone just trades back and forth for a quick penny, could care less about what the company does for a living, and at the end of the day go home flat? Well, I used to think it was the first. I thought that's what we were dealing with here. Unfortunately, it's turned into the second, and that's not a healthy system. What you need to get back to are the roots of the market. Why are we here? What do we do? We try to help companies. Intel was a $7 million IPO when it came out years ago, and look at it now. That's why we're here. So, you know, maybe it takes drastic reform. Maybe it takes something like, well, we're going to create a market where the spreads are wider, but you could have to add, you know, you must be a liquidity provider for a certain amount of time with a certain amount of size, because you do have to put some economic incentives back there for some of these market makers to support companies, to do the roadshow, so that investors see what's going on again. You don't have it. What you have are all the small to mid-sized brokers pretty much out of the business because there was no economics for them anymore. No one's supporting these deals anymore. And you get this. You get a casino type of market. Not necessarily the best thing.
No, we want the markets to efficiently allocate capital. And obviously, when it's just a casino, that's not happening. And also with that, I think I worry, you know, when we look at what's going to bring America back, you know, at some point we say, well, probably we're going to have to bring our manufacturing back. You know, that's going to take a lot of capital investment. At some point, we're probably going to want the financial industry, all due respect, to maybe garner a smaller share of the total pie. You know, we'd like to be have true productive industry sort of at the base again. But really, one of the main things we still have going for us is we've got this really big, deep liquid capital market. And one of the things I worry about, reflecting off of my own loss of confidence, is that ultimately we might see capital flight. I mean, there's no reason smart people in Hong Kong can't set up an exchange or anywhere in the world. It turns out that the degree of difficulty in setting up financial trading is not as high as you might think. It's not the same barrier you have with an Intel. That's an enormous barrier. So I'm really worried about the overall impact that allowing this sort of sanctioned theft, if you will, to sort of run right out in plain view. I'm worried about the impact of that on our markets over time.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that, you know, that's the bigger question here is, you know, you know, when you do lose the confidence and you don't have the capital allocation being done properly, then what are we looking at here? You know, why are we doing this? And then what are the, you know, the bigger ramifications? But unfortunately, most people just see the trade that's in front of them right now. They're not looking forward 5 years from now. They don't really care. They just say, well, I'm going to make a lot of money doing what I'm doing right now, and I could care less. Well, that's where you hope that your regulators and your exchange executives and the bigger, you know, people with a bigger picture come and step in, but they're not doing it. It's just not happening yet.
Okay, so I totally get that, and I'm wondering now, as we come into the close here, what can the average investor do to protect themselves, given everything we've just talked about?
Well, I think obviously the first thing is always making sure you're staying up on what's going on. There's a lot out there. There's a ton of information. You know, we try to filter it out. And, you know, we run our own little blog where we'll post a lot of stuff. But you got to be knowledgeable of all of these different types of market structure changes. You have to understand that there are 13 exchanges and 40 dark pools that kind of are intermingled right now. But if you're an investor, yeah, do your homework. You know, if you like a stock, go ahead and buy it. Yeah, after you did your own homework and your own research and you feel that this is a fairly valued company, well, yeah, am I going to tell you not to buy it? No. But, you know, don't follow the Momo train and the momentum train and thinking that I'm going to get on board this stock because it went from 100 to 130. I'm going to make some points here, because as we've seen in the last few days particularly, when momentum stops, it just stops and it just gets crushed. Look at some of these stocks like Cree and F5 and Coinstar just over the past few days. They've been destroyed. Because that's momentum leaving. Now, those aren't real investors, right? Those are just quick flip artists. Well, if you get caught in that game, you're going to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about it. But if you're a long-term guy and you like XYZ stock, well, I'm not going to say not to buy it. But you still have to be aware and in the back of your mind that this is an equity market that has changed. It is no longer, you know, centrally driven auction places like it used to be. It is now a fragmented market where there are different competing players with their own financial interests at heart that not necessarily are not looking out for your best interest. So look out for yourself and do your own homework.
And I suppose that applies also to the big players, the pensions, you know, at the state, municipal, corporate levels. Those big players also need to really take advantage of their services like what you're offering and or other companies to really be sure they know what's going on.
They have to be extremely careful. There's all sorts of transaction cost analysis that they can be running that is now, it's a lot more effective nowadays than it used to be. They need to watch their trades. People think sometimes trading is just a commoditize if you're a large investor. No, that's where the slippage is happening. And they have to be extremely careful where those orders are being routed, which exchanges they're going to, who's incented to take that order. And yeah, that's the nitty gritty. But you know what? Like I said before, those pennies, you know, nickels and dimes make quarters. It heads up. And that's what you have to be really careful of. And I think a lot of institutions are doing a good job at that. And they are really now, especially over the last couple of years, asking a lot more questions than they used to ask. But they have to keep the pressure on because, if, you know, no one's going to give it to you. You have to really kind of push it out there and say, no, I want to know what you're doing with my order. Why are you sending it to that location? What's going on over there? Who's part of that order? What toxic pool am I going to next? And if they do, and then those are the institutions that will do a better job. And if you're an investor in one of these funds, actually, you can ask. Hey, what's your trading strategy? You know, do you have some reports that I can see that have showed that your transaction cost is lower than your competitors? You can do that.
That's great advice. So what if we wanted to change this, though, and get back to perhaps a more well, let me phrase that differently. If we wanted our markets to function again like markets probably should, and I'm putting a lot of emphasis on that word should, who do we need to pressure?
Well, it starts from D.C. There's no doubt about it. You know, the politicians are the ones who can, you know, who control the purse strings of the SEC at this point, right? If the SEC is not getting funded properly, well, then they're not going to be able to watch and do what they're supposed to be doing. But really, you know, they need to understand and the pressure needs to be put on them as to, hey, these markets aren't necessarily what you see. We don't want to wait for another May 6th. Okay, because I can guarantee you if May 6th happens again, my phone's going to start to ring and everyone's going to want to know, hey, Joe, remember that you were talking about that stuff? Oh, yeah, this is a representative of so-and-so's office. We need to know more about it. Well, it's too late. Okay, these guys need to be right now investigating and looking at, you know, certain market structure principles. And like I said before, certain exchanges are only owning pieces of others. It starts in D.C. Unfortunately, you're going into a gunfight with a knife, because in D.C. right now, mm-hmm. are lobbyists who are very well funded, extremely well funded by the other side of the industry that has their goal is to keep everything the same. Don't change a thing. We love it just the way it is. You know, we don't want to hear that the markets are unfair, and you know why? It spreads are, and this is the line they'll say, spreads have never been less. You know, costs are low, and then they'll show all of these good things. They'll point to academic papers which have basically been paid for by them, and they'll always, and the politician will look at it and say, "Yeah, looks good to me." Okay, well, when's that donation coming in? That's the problem. That's where it starts. So you got to kind of, you know, go to your elected representative. If you see an SEC concept release, which came out in January of last year, read it, comment on it. They have a public forum where all comments are going. If the SEC, and they did get a ton of comments last year, sees that the investors care about this, they're going to have to act.
Okay. So everybody, we should all stay alert to what's going on, keep up on it, understand how the markets have changed, and then if we can, let's get some pressure on DC and the SEC, because it sounds like what we need is we need to get some daylight on this, and we need some regulation on it, because it's the Wild West. It sounds like a giant fight cage to me, you know, those cage matches they have, only there's like a million participants in it or something like that. It's
it's a dark kind of world where a lot of people don't see what's going on, and there's a famous quote from Judge Brandeis, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Okay, and that's exactly what we need here. We need to continue showing the light, see, hey, what is going on? I need to know. You know, that's what we've kind of been, one of our missions over the last couple of years. Like I said, our job is to trade, but we kind of took this on as a project, and the next thing we knew, it kind of morphed into something much bigger, but now we feel responsible to continue on making sure we know as much as we can and sharing with everybody.
Fantastic. I need to thank you for the work you're doing, because I'm not aware of anybody else doing it as well or as completely, and it's interesting to me that it's managed to fall upon you. Well, sometimes you just got to pick something up and run with it. I feel like I can relate to that. Before I let you go, I've just got to ask your observations on one thing, because it really stuck with me for a time, and it keeps rattling in my brain. And so a while back, Sergey Aleinikov was charged and then, I guess, finally convicted with stealing proprietary trading software from Goldman. And at the time, the assistant U.S. attorney, he said, and this is straight out of a Bloomberg article, said the theft poses a risk to U.S. markets. And then he went further and he really raised my eyebrows, because he said, the bank has raised the possibility that there is a danger that somebody who knew how to use this program could use it to manipulate the markets in unfair ways.
Wow.
I repeat, he said, manipulate the markets in unfair ways. So I have two questions. First of all, is it possible that he stole some of this HFT code or something like that? And second of all, is it possible to manipulate markets in fair ways?
Well, I bet the U.S. attorney, or at least Goldman Sachs in that situation, I bet they wish that the U.S. attorney never said that, because that is what really caused the firestorm to go off. Once that quote particular that you just read, a lot of people saw that and said, whoa, what's going on here? Can one code, can one programmer manipulate the markets? And, I mean, the courts have convicted him, so the courts must have decided that he did steal something. And, you know, I don't know exactly what went on over there. But it is scary to hear that. Can somebody manipulate the markets? Can one person? I don't know. I don't have the answer. But I know that if a U.S. attorney is saying that, well, then, gosh, you know, you got to really raise your eyebrows and wonder what's going on back here. You know, who are the major players? How much of the market are they controlling? There's lots of questions. And unfortunately, again, if you don't have the manpower and the computing power as the police, let's just say, to monitor this stuff, you'll never know. So if you ask that question to an SEC person, they don't even know the answer, right? They don't have or at least they haven't said. Okay, but if it is going on, and there are lots of suspicions out there, and the SEC in their concept report last year said something about something called momentum ignition, which is a strategy that's being used to push stocks around. Well, that sounds like manipulation to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they just asked a lot of questions. You know, what do you think of momentum ignition? Does it exist? Well, if they're asking questions, well, something must be going on. But again, I wish I knew the answer. I don't know. There are times when I'm trading a stock and I'm going, what the heck is this? You know, what is going on here? You know, so yeah, lots of people have lots of questions, which adds to suspicions, which adds to less confidence. So let's get it back. Let's get some, you know, let's shine some light on this stuff, and then we'll find out.
Well, this is hugely important work, and it's very important. I agree. Everybody should follow up on it. So if people want to follow up with you and find out what you're posting and writing and up to, where would they do that?
They can go to, we have a website. It's Themis Trading, THEMIS trading.com. And You know, there's nothing that we publish that we charge for. That's not what we do here. We have a blog that we run, and it's all, anybody can access it, and you can view it, you can comment on it. You know, we love when we get comments, and we'll post almost every day. It's pretty much a market structure related topic. Myself and my partner Sal are also on Twitter. I'm under the Joe Saluzzi ID, and my partner Sal is Themis Sal, and we're on Twitter, and we post a lot of stuff on Twitter during the day on things that we see, and we'll comment on markets as well. That's probably the, you know, the best place, and occasionally you'll see me popping up on Bloomberg or CNBC.
Well, fantastic. I really want to thank you for your time, for the work that you're doing, and for helping to bring some light to this dark area. It really needs doing.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share, Chris. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartenson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.